This is a defining moment for Russia.
Two planes carrying bodies of some of the victims of the downed flight MH17
are set to arrive. Anger and disbelief. A lot of people were asking themselves how this could happen.
Они погибли, стали жертвами войны, которую нужно.
По сути речи, Владимир Путин в первый раз признал наличие рычагов влияния на Украине.
Never before in its post-Soviet history has Russia been in such a horrific position as it is now. All possibilities, from a major war to a junta in the Kremlin, are possible. That was the message of a leading Russian journalist in a remarkable open appeal this week to the Russian elite. In a July 22nd article, Yevgenia Elbats, editor of the magazine Novoye Vremya, or New Times, called on the Russian elite and those with Vladimir Putin's ear to prove that they are not just greedy and fearful people, and to persuade the Kremlin leader to change course before they are left, quote, without a country. What Elbats calls Putin's Czechish entourage has led him not just to a dead end, but also into a nightmare, in which he will go down in history as someone who has the blood of innocent children on his hands, end quote. It's unclear what, if any, effect Elbats' dramatic appeal had on the Russian elite, but what is clear is that in the aftermath of the shooting down of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, Russia is, yet again, moving into new and uncharted political territory. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hey, Brian.
And joining us here in Prague is Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome back, Mirhat.
Hi.
Well, it's been a week of mixed and sometimes confusing signals. First, we had Putin's midnight video message posted on the Kremlin's website, in which, quite frankly, he looked haggard and unsure of himself, and in which he also vacillated between being confrontational and being conciliatory. Then we had that Dr. Strangelove-like briefing by the Defense Ministry, where they made the claim that a Ukrainian Su-25 had been tracking Malaysia Air Flight 17, apparently unaware of the fact that an Su-25 can fly at a maximum altitude of 7,000 meters and Flight 17 was flying at 10,000 meters. Next, we had Putin's comments after convening the Security Council, which he also sent mixed messages. He pledged to use his influence over the separatists in eastern Ukraine to assure that a thorough investigation of the downing of Flight 17 would take place, but he disavowed any responsibility for the tragedy. He accused the West of orchestrating the conflict in Ukraine and warned that similar tactics will not work in Russia, and he pledged to counter any moves by NATO toward Russia's borders. Putin also said there were no plans to clamp down on civil society, but on the same day he signed into law tougher punishment for public calls of separatism in Russia, including up to 4 years in jail. No mention of separatism in Ukraine in that announcement, apparently. Sean, what do you make of this goulash?
Well, you know, the last couple of days has been one of those exercises in trying to read Vladimir Putin. It's been quite difficult because he is giving mixed messages, and you are getting mixed messages out of the Russian government. For me, I can't help but see this as some sort of lack of coherent policy, and that they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do and how they're going to move forward. Because on the one hand, you have some interpretations where Putin is being conciliatory, right? He's giving some sort of – he's going to cooperate with the investigation around Flight 17. He's going to use his influence to kind of pressure the separatists in eastern Ukraine. But on the other hand, he's reminding the West that Russia is a great power and that they're going to meet any potential, you know, long-term threats that NATO is going to put forward. So you're getting him standing pat on the one hand, but being conciliatory on the other. And Elbats's article does raise the question of where does the Russian elite fall with this? You do get some indication from the Russian press that you have a split within the elite. You have a camp of doves, mostly around financial interests and those who do international business. And you have a camp of hawks, which are mostly around the defense industry. And it seemed for a while that the doves were ascendant. And you see, you had some sort of de-escalation on the part of Putin. That is a week before the Flight 17 was downed, where you had them then arming Eastern Ukrainian separatists. So it seemed like the hawks were seemed to have more of Putin's ear. But the real question is who does have Putin's ear, and is Putin willing to listen?
Yeah, and another question that came to my mind, you mentioned one of the conciliatory gestures. He said it was the pledge to help with the investigation. But on the other hand, he kind of, from his perspective, played this pretty well, because by delaying for so long, I don't see how they're going to have an investigation right now. The crash site is so compromised. There are reports that other airplane parts have been mixed in. The rebels had not only compromised the site, had intentionally done so intentionally, mixing in other airline parts. There were some reports in the press to that effect. How do you have a true forensic? I mean, the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming, but how do you have a true forensic investigation in this sense? So in this sense, the conciliatory gesture wasn't really a conciliatory gesture. He delayed just long enough to mean you're not going to be able to have any investigation now. The results are going to be able to be questioned. He's made it pretty difficult. Mirka, you, unlike Sean and I, you grew up in the Soviet Union. And when we were talking off mic a little bit earlier today, you drew some interesting contrasts between how situations like this played out then and how this situation is playing out now. And why don't you share your insights with our listeners, because I thought it was pretty interesting.
Well, I just remember when the first Boeing was shot down by the Soviets in the 80s. I was in the Soviet Army. And Lieutenant Fedorov came very excited and very nervous. He just asked all the surgeons, we were surgeons, to come to the separate room and instructed us to gave a special lecture to our subordinates, explaining them that a spy plane came to our territory and shot down. And all this stuff, I remember. One version said that somehow they found out that the pilot aboard that plane, a South Korean plane, was a Japanese military pilot or something like that. All these things.
We're talking about the Korean Airlines.
Yeah, Korean Airlines. In which was shot down in the 80s there by the Soviet missile. Now the situation is very different, and my thinking is that Putin is finding himself in a completely different situation where he probably even didn't realize he's going to have. If in the 80s, in the Soviet time, there was a general line of this Communist Party, and there was not such a thing as oligarchs.
They weren't called that.
Yeah, there was a political elite, but it was not like, we're not talking about billions of dollars earning money somewhere and, you know, businessmen doing like super wealthy, lucrative, advantages from all what's happening there. But in this case, Putin is now between the oligarchs who are scared to lose their money or to get some, financial problems. And on one hand, and on the other hand, we have almost 90% of the population of Russia who want more from Putin, who would never probably, and I believe in that they would never forgive him if he steps back in this situation, and Putin is in the corner.
Of his own making.
Yeah, his own making, yeah. And this is a situation which he probably never realized he's going to be in, because when the situation in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, for instance, was developing, well, everything went smoothly. There were no sanctions, nothing. And
That was below the radar.
Below the radar and all the stuff. And, of course, luckily for everyone, civil airplanes were shut down, that even though there were some military operations going on there. But here, right now, the situation is very difficult. That's why we see some mixed messages by him. He's contradicting. I mean, he says one thing and then he says another thing. We're not going to закручивать гайки. Right. We're not going to do this. We're going to allow the civil society to develop on one hand. And on the other hand, I just want to add to what you said. He said that up to 4 years for calling for separatism. But it's very important here. He said in the same law said the calling for separatism using the internet and online resources can be punished up to 5 years in jail.
And they've also criminalized claiming that Crimea is not part of Russia.
Kind of
annexation denialists, yeah. I guess is what we could call that. You mentioned the oligarchs, Mirka, and I saw an interesting piece in Bloomberg shortly after Flight 17 was shot down. I just want to quote from the first paragraph because it basically sums it up. Russia's richest businessmen are increasingly frantic that President Vladimir Putin's policies in Ukraine will lead to crippling sanctions and are too scared of reprisals to say so publicly. If Putin doesn't move to end the war with Ukraine in the wake of last week's downing of Malaysian Airlines jet in rebel-held territory, he risks becoming an international outcast like Belarus's Alexander Lukashenko, whom the U.S. famously labeled Europe's last dictator, one Russian billionaire said on condition of anonymity. Sean, how serious do you think this is? I mean, it's taking this together with the Al-Bats appeal. Where she's saying it's show us that you're just not frightened and greedy. And on the other hand, yeah, we have Bloomberg reporting that indeed the oligarchs are frightened and greedy. What do you see here? Can the oligarchs challenge Putin in this situation or not? I have my doubts for one.
Yeah, I have my doubts too. I think they have to walk a thin line here because on the one hand, you know, they could face some reprisals, particularly around this time where you have this attempt to create a national unity against external threat. Like in the when the Crimea situation began, you have this fear amongst the oligarchs that if they step out of bounds, they could easily be crushed. So Putin really here could exercise his kind of autocratic power against them. On the other hand, they're rightly worried. I mean, it's getting serious with these sanctions. This morning, it seems like the EU is going to move forward with sanctions. And these are the sanctions that really matter. If the EU comes out with tough sanctions, they will have more of an impact on the Russian elite than, say, the American ones. So this could become really serious. And I would imagine behind the scenes, they're trying to pressure Putin in some way to kind of de-escalate.
Yeah. No, I agree with what you said about sanctions. I mean, a lot of people have been maligning the sanctions as light. But one thing, if you look at the sanctions, I mean, from the very beginning, the U.S. sanctions were tougher than the European sanctions for obvious reasons. Europe has a lot more to lose here. But each step, they've each gotten tougher and tougher and tougher. Now it's getting bumping up against like the wall, though, because the next step, I mean, I don't see where the U.S. can go now except for sector sanctions. Mm-hmm. But if we get into, if we're talking level three sanctions, Iran-style sanctions, that would cripple the Russian economy. I saw some things that Europe has considered as like export of technology to be used in the energy sector. Well, you want to talk about crippling the Russian economy. I mean, this is the dirty little secret, but Gazprom's very dependent on technology transfers from Western energy companies, for example. So there's a lot of things that can be done here that can bite. And I know Russia's been ridiculing the sanctions, but These things are going to begin to bite. They're not going to bite today or tomorrow or next week, but over time, they're going to begin to bite more. Another thing I noticed this week that was pretty interesting, the three heavyweight U.S. senators, it was Dianne Feinstein of California, the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Carl Levin of Michigan, and Robert Menendez of New Jersey, proposed naming the Donetsk People's Republic as a terrorist organization. Now, this is just a proposal. It's just something that came out in a letter. They also called for tougher sanctions on the Russian energy industry. But they put that in there, and that's interesting. That's interesting because since this whole thing started, Ukraine's been calling their operation in the East an anti-terrorist operation. As journalists, we have not been using that terminology. We've been very careful to say what the Ukrainian government calls its anti-terror. We've been avoiding the terminology, and Mirkat knows you're right in the news every day. But now, what if this gets any legs, and I'm not sure if it's going to get any legs, what does that make Russia? It makes them a state sponsor of a terrorist organization. Who the hell is going to want to do business with somebody who's a state sponsor of a terrorist organization? So this could get very, very sticky pretty soon. You had Alexei Kudrin. Now, I do pay attention to what Alexei Kudrin says. He's not in anywhere close to power anymore. But At one time, he was a close friend to Putin. I'm not sure what the status of their friendship is right now, but he at one time was very close to Putin. He's coming out and very publicly warning about the isolation of Russia. So this could get sticky. Mirko, what are your thoughts on
It will. With the situation might be similar to. Of course, Russia is not any Middle Eastern country. It's not Libya, but the analogies are there with what happened to Libya. At least the attitude to Russia might be to the same as the attitude was towards the Slobodan Milosevic Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm not sure if it'd go that far, but the first steps toward that are done. And I also want to remind that these three senators came to this proposal just days after Poroshenko, in his interview to CNN, said and called them terrorists. And also he said, we urge the Western part of the world to recognize Luhansk People's Republic and Donetsk People's Republic as terrorist organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of a signal that they heard his signal, but because CNN was broadcast there in the United States. And
these three senators, I mean, let's face it, if John McCain said this, I wouldn't have taken the kind of notice. Not to diminish John McCain, but I mean, he says things like this all the time. Mm-hmm. But these are three Democrats. These are three Democrats who are not particularly dovish, but they certainly aren't terribly hawkish either, certainly in the case of Levin. But it really caught my attention because these are heavyweights who don't tend to make statements. If Lindsey Graham said this, if John McCain said this, I would have taken note of it. It certainly would have been news, but it wouldn't have surprised me. Mm-hmm. But when you see three senators of this rank and with the reputations of these three senators, it did surprise me and made me think, maybe this could get some legs. On the other hand, it's interesting you raised the Lockerbie Gaddafi and the Milosevic. In my last two blogs, I got a lot of hell on Twitter for making these comparisons, but I thought they were useful to make. That it was Kirill Kobrin's comment in last week's podcast that Putin has crossed the Lockerbie line, and it provided a lot of the fodder for our discussion. The Milosevic meme has been out there for a while. But Sean, what do you think? I mean, does Putin have an immunity to rogue state status because of a number of reasons? Russia's energy wealth, nuclear weapons, the degree to which Russia's integrated with the world economy. Is there a bit of immunity there from this?
Well, I would say that to a large extent there was an immunity. But as you guys talked about last week, the downing of this passenger plane is very much a game changer. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it's a game changer on more in the sense of Russia's image in the world. Mm-hmm. Before you had people who were saying – or countries that were uncomfortable with Russia, but they were still dealing with Russia. Now you're seeing them kind of get fed up with Russia. And Putin himself, it really shows that he's in a corner. Mm. And how he's going to proceed is very delicate. On the one hand, he has to save face to a large extent for his own public, because he's ratcheted up Russian society so much with supporting these separatists in eastern Ukraine. But on the other hand, internationally, he's getting increasing pressure to do something. And the fear, the result of this could be that Russia becomes somewhat of a prize state. I think that. I don't know if I would say that Russia has crossed the Lockerbie line yet, but in the next couple of months, it's going to determine how much they're going to actually move to crossing that line, or they're going to move back.
I mean, one of the things, I think psychologically we have kind of crossed that line, but then there's kind of there's this residual of that Russia is so integrated into the world economy. I mean, the amount of business Russia does with the European Union is huge. And disentangling that is hard. This isn't Libya. This isn't Serbia. This is a country with enormous energy and economic clout, and that's made it now clear. It's clearly with you can see why they've made it their business to make sure that they are integrated. On one hand, being integrated is dangerous for Russia because the sanctions really will bite. Right. If it's really going to cause over time a severe downturn in standards of living in Russia for at every level, from your oligarchs down to the working class. But on the other hand, Russia has clout there because Europe's got a lot to lose too. We could have a repeat of a global financial downturn. The shock of pulling Russian capital out of the world. I think this is going to happen slowly. I think we've crossed this line now, and I think there's going to be a slow, very slow decoupling of this. Europe's going to diversify its energy. The City of London is going to have to learn to live without. So, and let's face it, the City of London, as Mark Galeotti has pointed out in this podcast, the City of London can survive without Russian capital. Russia can't survive without financing from the City of London. So there's that as well. There was an interesting bit. Another interesting bit I noticed this week. Andrei Piankovsky, in a piece in Russia Monitor, wrote that the main division in the elite, or is in an interview with Piankovsky actually, is between what he called a national kleptocracy and an international kleptocracy, basically. So you have the people, the national kleptocracy is fine with Putin doubling down on conflict because they're just, they want to pillage the national economy. The international kleptocracy, in order to keep stealing, have to have access to the kind of respectable international finance. What do you think, Marika? Is this a good scheme?
That makes sense. And that's exactly why Putin was pushing all his mm-hmm. businessmen, and especially those who are in power, who are occupying some official positions and posts, to withdraw their money from international banks to the Russian banks. And special laws were adopted during 2012, 2013, prohibiting the officials to have any property abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Putin is a very classic, very professional and experienced KGB officer. He was preparing for all this, and at least, if not fully, but he at least did everything to minimize the possible effects of what he's going to do.
Yeah, it's almost like he saw not this, but specifically, but something along the lines of this coming, and he seemed to be prepping the elite. No, Sean? What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been going on for at least well over a year now, where he's calling for the deofshorization of Russian capital and bringing it back into Russia, getting Russian capital out of offshore accounts. So I don't know if he saw something coming, but this has certainly been part of the kind of ideological pivot, or the foreign policy pivot, that Putin has made since he came back into office. And that is to reconsolidate the elite, try to decouple them from effects in the West. And if my memory serves me correct, in his meeting with his statements at the Security Council meeting, he even referenced this idea of being vulnerable if you have your capital abroad. Mm. So I think that this kind of drive to decouple has been a feature of his presidency since he came back in 2012, but it's only become more important since this problems with the West. Now, on the one hand, I think this is mostly a domestic thing. This is about reconsolidating the elite and bringing them back to a Russian stance, so essentially Putin can exercise more control of them. If Russian capital is in Russia, if the elite's capital is in Russia, the Russian government and the Kremlin can exercise more control over them in the long run.
Yeah, but and one has to wonder how consolidated the elite is right now. I mean, Putin's numbers are high right now.
Yeah.
But those numbers, first of all, there's big problems as we've again pointed out on this podcast numerous times, of measuring the popularity of a leader when there's no alternative. There's big problems, and those numbers can go back down just as easily as they shot up as the situation gets bad. Right now, given those numbers, there's people are afraid to challenge Putin inside the elite. But one has to wonder how consolidated this elite is. Does it look consolidated to you, Marikat?
I'm not sure. We know that. Read the report by Levada Center recently. The number of the minority in Russia, I'm not talking about big oligarchs, but intellectuals who do not support Crimea annexation or what's happening in Ukraine, they are leaving Russia, not necessarily for the Western part of the world, even to Georgia.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Or to Ukraine, for that matter.
Ukraine, and, you know, to Baltic states, anywhere, because they are scared, because if
They're scared to express their opinion. It's one thing. They're also scared. They're scared to express their opinions, but they're also scared to for the future of their children. And the system, which is the environment in Russia right now, where you know this nationalism is covering everything. I mean, it's overwhelmingly covering everything, and even if you're just getting a new job or anywhere, the people ask some questions they never asked before. I mean, this is very...
You mean like loyalty tests? Or
yeah, loyalty tests. So I think, I'm sure, we're talking about some middle class intellectuals, but I'm sure these kind of people are among oligarchs as well.
Yeah. No, I'm sure it's among the oligarchs first and foremost, because these are the people that, that have traveled and are going to be likely to have...
Yeah, they see the future of their children, at least for the education to be given to their children. They want it to be given in Europe, in the United States. Well, Putin's own daughter, we turned out she lives in Holland.
In Holland, yeah.
So
yeah.
So this is, you know, there's many things to lose for them, and they just... there are people who... who are, well, let's say there are some divisions, there's people who are very, very concerned and they're cautious to support Putin openly.
And one other reason why I think this might come to a head and why Russia might be very isolated sooner than we think is I don't know if either of you noticed the Pew poll that came out a couple of weeks ago on global attitudes towards Russia. Now, this was before the downing of Malaysia Air Flight 17. And some of the numbers, frankly, shocked me. I mean, it's been this kind of truism that the Europeans are more favorably disposed towards Russia than the United States, for example. Well, guess what? They're not. Mm-hmm. According to the Pew poll, 74% of Europeans, your EU-wide, are look at Russia negatively. Well, just 72% of Americans do. But then you look inside those numbers and you look at places like that we traditionally think as the pro-Russian states in Europe, Germany, France, Italy, right? Well, guess what? It's 79% of Germans have a negative attitude towards Russia. Both France and Italy are in the 70s. This was before 200 Europeans died in this flight, which is, let's face it, was the direct result of an insurgency that Putin created in eastern Ukraine. So regardless of all the business that's being done, you're beginning to see a disconnect between the European elite and the European public. Right. You're seeing this disconnect. And these are democratic countries, unlike Russia. So sooner or later, you're going to have democratic pressure on the elites along these lines.
Well, just one example, when Angela Merkel was together with Putin at the soccer match, the final of the championship in Brazil, on her personal account on Facebook in German, there were like hundreds of comments saying, Guten Tag, Mrs. Ribbentrop.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean,
no, and this is public opinion in Europe. And I was shocked when I don't know what you guys thought when you saw those numbers, but I was frankly shocked. Sean, any last thoughts before we move on to the second section?
Yeah, I think and this goes back to Al Batz's column. I think that it really lies with the elite because they're really in a difficult position, as we've talked about. You have enormous public pressure where the public is on the side of Putin and kind of pressing this insurgency in Ukraine. But the elite is increasingly nervous, and we are getting some indications of that. And this will create, I think, since the elite politics in Russia is what really matters, this will certainly have some sort of long-term fallout for how Putin and the elite get along, how various factions of the elite develop, and really going into the next presidential election. Yeah. I could see some long-term ramifications of what's going on now for the next couple of years.
Yeah, and as Mark Galeotti likes to point out in this podcast, court politics is everything in Russia. Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion about the fallout from the Malaysian Airlines tragedy and its effect on Russian politics. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us here in Prague is Mirhat Sharabjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. I would also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
We will adequately and proportionately respond to the advance of NATO's military infrastructure toward our state borders. We will not turn a blind eye to the development of the global missile defense system and the buildup of strategic non-nuclear high-precision weapons. We are often told that the missile defense system is a defense installation. Not at all. It is an offensive weapon.
Well, that, of course, was President Vladimir Putin speaking after meeting with the Security Council this week in one of his less conciliatory and more confrontational statements. Putin isn't panicking. He isn't scared, and he isn't backing down, no matter what the consequences. That was the opinion of another high-profile Kremlin watcher and Putin biographer. In an article this week in Slate, Masha Gessen, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, argued that Putin is engaged in a, quote, war of civilizations with the West, between Russia's traditional values and what many Russians call the West's homeofascism. Ukraine just so happened to be the first battleground in that clash, and the downing of Flight 17 turned what had been an underhanded operation into an open confrontation, Gessen writes. But Putin is in it for the long haul, she argues, and has no intentions of backing down. Quote, he may or may not have to cede a little on Ukraine, but that's all right. It's just one battle in the giant war against the West he has already unleashed. Is she right, Sean?
I don't know. I think we have to be careful.
Provocative article. Very provocative article. Very interesting article.
As always from Masha Gessen. But I think we need to be careful of what we mean by the West here. Now, if we mean what I think Masha Gessen means, and I think Masha Gessen and Vladimir Putin kind of share the idea about the West. They just disagree on its value. If the West is progressive, inclusive, multicultural, then this certainly is a clash with those values in Russia. But there's also other aspects of the West that Russia could never decouple itself with. It wasn't able to do this even under the Soviet Union. Now Russians are steeped in Western consumerism, Western popular culture. You have segments of the Russian population that have Western values. They travel to Europe. So this is really a kind of clash of identities and values rather than a clash of civilizations. Mm-hmm. I'm somewhat uncomfortable with this kind of putting these two camps and seeing them clash. Putin, as we've talked about many times before, is certainly engaged in an ideological campaign where trying to define, I think, traditional Russian values vis-a-vis what he perceives as a decadent West.
Yeah, no, I like the way you frame it, and I think probably that's what Masha meant. And it's interesting how all of our themes begin to converge. I mean, God, Sean, remember how many podcasts we did in the past on what we call the cultural wars here between the West and Russia when we were looking at the anti gay and lesbian campaign that was coming out of the Kremlin. It all does kind of come together if you remember. In the period before when Ukraine was deciding, before Ukraine was supposed to sign the association agreement back at the end of last year, the thing that kicked off this whole conflict, one of the campaigns that was sponsored by Medvedchuk and the pro-Russian faction in Ukraine was, if you sign this, you're going to have gay marriage in Ukraine. They were even trying to frame it this way then. So there is something to this. Now, this raises an interesting question, because you said Russians are steeped in consumerism at this right now. So this part of the West, they can't decouple. And if you follow the logic, I mean, Putin's basically declared a holy war. Right? And so it's a holy war versus consumerism. Are Russians ready to give up their consumer goods and their consumer culture for the sake of a holy war? This is what I mean by these numbers right now. It's all well and good to be all psyched about the annexation of Crimea and have 80%+ liking Putin. But what about when I can't have my iPhone and my iPad and go on my European vacation anymore? Am I so psyched about this holy war then? Well, what do you think, Mark? Are you shaking your head? No.
Oh, of course not. In the Soviet Union, from what we had and when we were younger, we still were looking at the West. And we're envying the ability of Western people to
have stuff,
have stuff, and consume stuff. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, all those dreams came true, and people in Russia and elsewhere in the former Soviet Union, they cherish it.
I'm sure about it, and they like it.
And they've pocketed it and found out they can have the anti-Westernism and the stuff at the same time,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but I want to mention here, we have to remember one thing. I think, well, that's my opinion. I think Putin's major agenda, major goal, or objective, if you want, is his own power.
Yes. And he's put himself in a position right now where he has to stay in power.
Yeah, he has to stay in power. And this idea with the anti-Western, politics and stuff is a tool to preserve his power and his position as a president of the Russian Federation. And I don't think I agree with Masha. This is like something what we call conflict of civilizations so far. It's an attempt of a person to preserve his power in this huge country. But what I agree with is that he will not stop.
Yeah.
He will not stop. He will do more and more and...
Masha makes a very interesting point in this piece. I don't know if either of you guys picked up on it, but she said that playing this anti-Western kind of civilizational clash card proved shockingly effective for Putin inside of Russia. And if you could think back a year ago on this podcast, all we were talking about was Navalny and the opposition and how Putin was in trouble and he was dead. And suddenly we haven't talked about Navalny in months on this podcast, if that. So, I mean, it was shockingly effective. But is it just a tactic, or is it something that now has a life of its own? This is an important question because there's kind of no turning back now. No,
there is no turning back.
Sean, what do you think?
Well, I think there is some turning back, and that all depends on the de-escalation of the rhetoric. I think the fact that we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that Putinism is based on a constant mobilization of society.
Yeah.
And that this is part of the kind of mobilization of the third term, right? This old social contract that we knew about for Putin's first two terms is now over because the economy is going down. It's the economic stability is becoming less and less.
And the middle class has rebelled
And the middle class has rebelled. So this political pivot was an attempt to reconsolidate Putin's rule by appealing to different sections of society, essentially to cobble together a Putin majority.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this, they ratcheted up the anti-Western rhetoric. They put forward laws and policies and just a sense of Russia's traditional values. And I think that this is really about trying to define what Russian traditional values are. And vis-a-vis the West. And I think this could de-escalate and kind of go away if the rhetoric goes away. Because to demobilize the Russian population, it would allow a lot of this stuff to kind of fade away, I think. Because the question that I have, and not being in Russia, it's really hard to answer this question. How much is the population really mobilized around this rhetoric? Are we just hearing voices in the media or are people really concerned about this stuff or are they just going about their daily lives?
I mean, that's a very, very, very good question. And I don't – even if you're on the ground in Russia, that's probably hard to answer. I mean, we're getting reports from our people on the ground in Russia every day. We're all reading the Russian press every day. When you listen to people like Lev Gudkov, it's real, but it's very ephemeral, I think. That would be my best guess. It's real, but it can dissipate very, very, very quickly. It may happen without a toning down of the rhetoric again, because Putin could tone down the rhetoric, de-escalate in Ukraine, but he's still got some serious questions to answer about the downing of this airplane and about the nearly 300 people who died in that airplane. I don't think the Dutch are going to let that go. Right. So he can de-escalate it, but has he hit this point of no return? Maybe he has to keep going, as Masha Gessen suggests in her article, because he's really he doesn't really have another exit, no?
Nor does he have another agenda.
Right.
For the Russian population, I think internationally we need to differentiate between international pressure and domestic pressure. Mm-hmm. He's getting a lot of international pressure around the downing of this flight, and I don't think going back to the way things were before is going to be very, very difficult.
Yes.
But domestically, I mean, we haven't seen any real indication that the Russian population actually believes that separatists even downed this plane because of Russian propaganda, based on articles about what's being put on Russian.
Do you see what was out today? This is mind blowing. The latest thing that's all over the Russian media is that the Ukrainians were holding military exercises in the area and accidentally shot down the plane with a Buk. Now, how Ukraine could be conducting military exercises in a part of Ukraine that's controlled by the separatists is beyond me. But the other thing was, this was the exact same thing that happened. Remember back in 2001 when they accidentally shot that plane down. That's exactly what happened. So they took something that happened. But anyway, the propaganda is mind blowing. But people are believing it. Yeah.
Yeah, people seem to be believing it. So Putin isn't really under any threat in terms of the Russian population, you know, being in pains over what happened, Russian responsibility in downing this plane. But the question is how long can Putin maintain this mobilization and keep the population engaged rather than slipping into kind of an apathetic, like, we've heard all this before, enough of it already, we just want to get on with our normal lives. And if that happens, then Putin has a serious problem because he has nothing to keep the population kind of satisfied in terms of social and economic terms.
Right. So if he doesn't deliver on the holy war front, and then the West, if the dynamic I expect to see continues, if people are going to be deprived of their consumer goods as well, what are you going to have? I mean, if how's the Russian population going to react to that? Basically, they're going to lose everything. They're going to lose their holy war or their crusade against whatever you want to call it, and their iPhones, or their European vacations. And that's a very dangerous situation for Putin. Russia's not going to be isolated. Putin's going to be isolated. You know? Merkat, there's something I actually want to, again, going back to, you had the benefit, or that's probably a poor choice of words, of you had the experience of growing up in the Soviet Union, unlike Sean and I. The propaganda, people seem to believe it. But what I'm hearing from every former Soviet citizen, and I talk to a lot of them in this building, is that, and I understand that the people in this building are not representative of all former Soviet citizens, but everybody says the same. We never believed the propaganda. We never, our Armenian service director was saying this to me today. He's like, I don't believe Russians believe this stuff. I was a citizen of the Soviet Union. I never believed this stuff. How do you explain, though, that people are buying it?
I don't know.
Or maybe...
the thing is that when we, our generation... who were born in 10 years or so after Stalin's death, we already were fed up with all this stuff. Right. And I was in a very different position. My father was a journalist in a satire journal, and he taught me that we don't believe, son, I'm a journalist. And we were listening to Radio Free Europe and Voice of America in the night in several languages. So in my case, it was different. But
yeah, you're unusual.
Yeah, but I worked in a factory as a metal worker for a couple of years after finishing the secondary school, and even people there, like workers, they didn't believe because
now these were Kazakhs in Kazakhstan, basically.
Well, they were Russians. They were Russians. Huh? They were Russians in Kazakhstan too. I mean, I grew up in a city
in a very Russified city.
Yeah,
that's right. Only
8% of the population were Kazakhs, even though it was a Kazakh city. But you know, people then they were, that's why there were anecdotes and stuff. But now in Russia, completely different story. The population of the Soviet Union, I'm not talking about Russians, but all the former republics, they went through hell when the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, you buy something in the morning, and then in the evening, the same thing costs like 10 times more.
Right, yeah.
You know, people lost, like my mom lost all her savings in 24 hours.
Right.
We're talking about 48,000 rubles, which is a huge amount of money. I mean... there was a period in the 90s where people in Russia and elsewhere in the former Soviet Union, they never want to repeat. And now, with Putin, they are in a completely different position. It's not probably not because of Putin, but that coincided with his,
This is, and this is, I think, Sean, actually, you'd have some good insights here because you're a historian of the early Soviet period, if I'm not mistaken, right? I mean, are we seeing, is this more, and I mean, Merkat's giving us what it was like in the 70s, where people, you know, didn't believe the propaganda.
And now they believe because they see a savior. They now live much better.
It's like the early Soviet period in terms of the way people are willing to buy propaganda. Is that...
I think, I mean, if I would make the period I know best, which is the 1920s, where you have a far more, the parameters of representation in the media were far broader than it was certainly in the 1930s.
Right.
And you could have, and you had multiple narratives on what was being reflected and represented in society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Russian media today, you have multiple narratives going on and multiple sources of media, and this is enough to maintain the idea that the media is, on the one hand, freer, that you have, you know, Viet MSD and Kommersant on the one hand, you have Russian television in terms of the spectrum, you have Russian television on the other. So people do have access through the internet to get alternative viewpoints. What makes, I think, Russian propaganda so effective now is that they really control the narrative. It's not really the facts so much as the way you assemble those facts. And what we've seen under Putin in particular is a narrative that has been constructed that's anti-Western and really putting doubt in the Western representation of reality.
Right.
And I think this is why it's so key.
Right. I think the operative word you, no. you – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Did I cut
you? No, go ahead.
I mean, I think the operative word there is doubt. If there was an interesting leader in The Economist today that was begins the kind of ridiculing the Su-25 claim that the defense ministry made that it was tracking the plane when a quick check of the specs of this plane can show you that it flies at 7,000 meters maximum. But what The Economist went on to say is that the point here isn't to convince people. It's to muddy the waters just enough where facts are negotiable like opinions. Everybody is entitled to their own facts. You know, Senator Moynihan was wrong. But
yeah, one more thing to mention. Just today, Zhuganov, Gennady Zhuganov, the leader of the Russian Communists, was reacting to the news that there was a criminal case, investigations, a probe opened against him in Ukraine.
In Ukraine, yeah.
And reacting to it again, he says, you know, how could you believe people who are shooting foreign planes on this guy?
As if it is a fact.
You know, right. Just to give it like, you know, in anything which is even not related to the fact, they just mention it, you know, and people listen to it, and this is like... The most powerful PR or black propaganda is usually more successful and more powerful when it's mentioned like in a not related cases, like a done deal, like it's proven and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's everywhere.
Right.
When people are listening to it on a regular basis, they believe really that just, well, it was Ukrainians who shut down this.
Right.
This plane.
Is this, I guess, before we wrap up, the last thing I'd like to say is, and Sean, and you said they've managed to master the narrative and assemble the facts in a way to the Western, anti-Western narrative they want, and at the same time create enough muddle in the West, hijacking news cycles here and there to muddle what people think in the West. Is this sustainable? Is it working great now, or it's working well enough now? Is it sustainable, you think?
I think it's sustainable, but the question is not whether it's sustainable over the long term, it's whether the intensity of it is sustainable.
Mm.
I think what this propaganda can come in ebbs and flows. On the, you know, we saw this in recent months where you had a really strong propaganda campaign against the fascist junta in Kiev, and then that de-escalated.
Right.
And so we see it kind of ebbs and flows of the intensity of this propaganda. I think this ebbs and flows is what can maintain it over the long term. When it's necessary to ratchet it up, you ratchet it up. When it's unnecessary, you just let things go kind of on a basic kind of low-key propaganda level.
Mm. Marikot, would you agree?
I agree, but I think in some cases it might last for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It depends, and... Unfortunately, we need some stories which would prove that the propaganda is lying, you know, and also people.
I don't even know if that cuts it because facts out and they just the stuff just sticks.
I don't know.
But
just the only thing is also we know that only 10% of the population of the Russian Federation travel abroad.
Right.
And those who do that, who have travel documents, so-called foreign passports, they usually go to, you know, Turkey, to United Arab Emirates once a year. This is it.
Right.
Not all of them go, even though this 10% of the Russian Federation who go abroad, they're mainly in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and western part of the Federation.
So I think the most when Russia is open, when people are wealthy and they're able, all of them are able to travel abroad on a more regular basis, when their children study abroad, you know, then probably something will change. At this point, you know, Russia will be in the same position, unfortunately, for a longer time. And one more thing, very importantly, this will affect the neighbors. I'm not talking about Ukraine. I'm talking about Kazakhstan in this case. You know, the popularity of Putin in Kazakhstan, believe it or not, is so high. It's higher than in Russia today among ethnic Russians.
Among ethnic Russians.
Yeah, yeah, because they... Putin's politics in Ukraine gave them the feeling of Big Brother again.
Yeah.
They now again are on the rise. And then, you know, I think the situation we are looking at now is going to last for more. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about Ukrainian crisis. I'm talking in general.
This general line, yeah.
Yeah.
Sean, any last words before we wrap up?
Yeah, one of the reasons I think what makes this propaganda so effective is that it feeds into, which is I think is another feature of Putin's third term, that Russia, a sense that Russia is being victimized by the West. It plays into this idea that we're encircled, that the West is trying to you know, threaten us. The West is a threat in general. And as long as the Russian population is attached to this idea of being a victim of Western threats, I think this propaganda will work, because as long as it seeds there's doubts in the Western narrative and that we have a different Russia narrative because we can't really trust what's coming from the West because they're out to get us, I think people will continue to believe in this stuff.
Yeah, and final word from me. I mean, I think, unfortunately, I think Masha Gessen's onto something here. And I think, but for this reason, Putin's kind of he's crossed this Lockerbie line, as we say. And as a result, he's in a position where he has to stay in power. Mm-hmm. He's not going to have a peaceful retirement now, you know, like he could have had back in 2011. He's not going to have a peaceful retirement. He has to stay in power. And since, Sean, as you point out, he has nothing else but this anti-Western narrative, he's got to stick with this. And he has to deliver something on this. So I think we are stuck with this Putin as long as there's a Putin in the Kremlin. Now, that said, I think this is going to run into a brick wall at some point because eventually this is going to run into forces that are going to create some kind of explosion. I mean, at some point, this road is going to take Russia to more and more sanctions, which means more and more deprivation for the Russian people. And that's where it seems to be going, although we have to continue to revise our narrative of this as the situation develops. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and East European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us in the studio here in Prague has been Mirhat Sharabjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Thank you, gentlemen, for the enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our producer, Anton Zolotich, who is filling in for Tanya Koncheva as she enjoys a nice sunny vacation from me. I'd also like to thank my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. And I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again, Nick, next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.